The following is an initiation dialogue and lecture given by His Holiness Hridayananda Das Goswami on April 16, 2008.
The only thing wrong with Lord of the Rings is that in Middle Earth there's no one to pray to. That's like the big flaw in it. There's no higher power. Even in Star Wars there's an impersonal higher power. You know, Shakti Rastu Te, which means may the force be with you. Shakti Rastu Te. Remember the force. So, it's Shakti Vishwara Luke.
Okay.
Actually, you would just say, in Sanskrit, you would just say, Shakti Vishwara Luke. You don't know about that, do you? You had a very sheltered life. This is good. Yeah, that's a boy. So, Krishna, yeah, but in Middle Earth, Madhya Bhumi, there's no one to pray to. It's the flaw. And, I mean, the closest they come, they have like their, just like demigods are called Amara, which literally means like deathless. Amara, Amrita, same thing. I mean, by the way, that's in English is the same. Like Martya is English mortals. Yes. You see, Martya, mortal, same thing. Mortality, Rityata. Even the T-Y, mortality, is Sanskrit. Mrityata, Mrityuta, or Martyata. The ta at the end makes it a noun.
Mrityanjaya.
Yeah. So anyway, so the elves are sort of Amaras in Lord of the Rings. Although they can trade it in for earthly romance. Hey, look, it's Dr. Chris. Hey, Dr. Chris.
Very nice to see you again.
Nice to see you. We're talking about, what would it be? Ambulieshwara, Lord of the Rings. So, yeah, we have to go on another trip, don't we?
Yeah. Anytime you want.
Really?
Yeah. Where do you want to go?
Oh, that sounds like, wait, well, who advertised that? Where do you want to go?
Microsoft, where do you want to go?
Yeah, we'll talk about that. So, yeah, see, like in Madhya Bhumi. Hey, Tess. Okay, shake it right in here. Saying how in Middle Earth, the defect in Middle Earth, there's no one to pray to. And, yeah, there's no, so to speak, there's no vault of heaven overhead.
If you read somewhere earlier. Talks about
the what?
Silmarillion. It's like the preface to Lord of the Rings, the trilogy.
Yeah.
They talk about the creation of the book, the Lord of the Rings.
And?
There is like a higher power.
And you pray to it?
It's like
deism.
It's more like
deism.
They're all way through this, but just born from him.
Just what?
Like Adam and Eve conceptual, like just born from him.
Yeah, repeat my point. That in Middle Earth, there's no one to pray to. There's no active higher power. And to create something, it's almost like someone that accidentally got a girl pregnant and doesn't know he has a child somewhere. You know, you have, like there's some kind of power to create the world, but it's interesting. There's an intellectualized form of theism. An intellectualized in which God is sort of excluded from any type of active participation in human history. Are you guys ready? You can all come forward. If the chair tips over backwards, you come too far. That will be your signal. Are you guys not? Oh, who's this?
This is my son, Moss.
What's his name?
Moss.
Hey, Moss, how do you do? Hey, Moss. Shake hands. Shake hands.
A lot of people here.
A lot of people here? That's okay. We're the good guys, Moss.
We're recording anyway. We're not skateboarding.
So there's, yeah, we're just talking about Middle Earth and the problem with Middle Earth, which is there's no one to pray to there. So Tolkien obviously was an intellectual. And if you look at Tolkien, some say Thomas Jefferson or Aristotle and so on, there's this tendency among certain intellectuals to think that they're sort of intellectually outgrown a full personal deity that actually intervenes in human history. And therefore, there's sort of a type of deism where God sets the ball rolling. God sets up the system, the laws of nature, gets the ball rolling. It's like, and then just steps back and all kind of self-assembles and things play out. And God kind of steps out of the picture. It's almost like your children have grown up and you have to just let them have their own lives. So, so that, as you described it, it's in, like in Middle Earth. Now, what's that book called?
It's called The Silmarillion. Silmarillion.
Silmarillion. Yeah, it seems like there's no real participation, at least in the movies.
Not in the movies at all.
What?
Not in the movies at all. Probably.
Yeah, they sort of took anything. But what is there in the original story? Is there anything like a spiritual power that's active?
Yeah, totally.
In the book?
Mm-hmm. Oh, not in the book.
In the Lord of the Rings.
They probably don't focus on it in trilogy as much.
But
it's Silmarillion, it's very clear with that idea.
But in the story itself, in other words, like, does anyone actually pray to someone? Is there any such thing as prayer? Is prayer effective?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Sure.
I'm trying to remember. I might have watched that movie so many times. I don't remember anything.
So, how are we going to proceed with initiations? Well, I could speak on that, on Diksha. Shita. That means cool. Shita, yeah. When I, at Mahalakshmi, at your initiation, did I explain about the word Diksha? I went through the history of the word Diksha.
I was there.
Yeah, we can do it again. You heard Jason? I can explain it again. The word Diksha is what we translate as initiation. It's, if you look at the history of how the word was used in Vedic culture. That's what I call the Punya Rasi. Opposite Punya's pirate. Huh? Papa in Sanskrit means sin. And Punya means piety. So I call him the Punya Rasi. Were you there, Balaram Chandra Prabhuji, when I explained about Diksha?
No.
Well, I'll explain it. It's, if you look at how the word Diksha is used in Vedic culture, like say from the Bhagavatam, just taking it from the Bhagavatam, Diksha meant something like initiation or consecration. And then it's interesting, in the older Vedic culture of fire sacrifices and so on, the idea was that just as we chant Hare Krishna, we come in direct contact with God or the Holy. And so in the older, in the ancient culture based on fire sacrifice, which you find everywhere, you certainly find it in Persia, the Zoroastrian thing, you find it in the Bible, fire sacrifice, you find it in the Iliad and the Odyssey. So there was a period thousands and thousands of years ago on Earth whether it's in Europe or Persia or India or, you know, anywhere or in the Middle East. Are you going to do that for the whole lecture? In the biblical culture, people perform fire sacrifice. Now, the interest, you know, the idea being that because fire in Sanskrit, agni, English, ignite, from agni. So the idea is that fire was, in a sense, considered to be almost like an earthly god or a deity that connected heaven and earth. Because fire is present on the earth as a consuming agent. The fire actually consumes the offering. So if you think of the fire sacrifice, and in the Bhagavad Gita, chapter 4, Krishna talks about sacrifice, and then he uses the actual physical, the language which describes the physical sacrifice, like fire, or the offering of ghee, clarified butter. And he takes this language and he transforms it into a symbolic philosophical language in which he describes the general action of making an offering and having the offering accepted and consumed. So, for example, Krishna says in chapter 4, some offer the sense objects into the fire of the senses. Some offer the actions of the senses into the controlled mind, and so on and so forth, where the actual physical fire and the offerings become just symbolic of the general act of making an offering, having the offering consumed. And so the idea was that the sacrifice, just like chanting Hare Krishna, brought one directly in touch with the divine. And obviously, if you're going to go see God, you should at least put on some clean clothes. So the idea was that... And also, you have to purify your consciousness. If you'd like to play there, even, or if he's hungry, you can give him something to eat. And also, you had to purify your consciousness. You had to purify your consciousness. So, Diksha was a process by which, before coming into contact with God, with the holy, you had to get yourself in a higher state of consciousness. And you find this even in Catholic culture, for example. I forget what they call it, Lent or something, where so many days you fast or you abstain from certain foods like meat and so on. And so it's the same idea. So for so many days before a holy sacrifice, a household or couple, for example, would be celibate, or they would restrict their eating in certain ways. The idea being they were basically mechanical techniques to get one into a higher state of consciousness so that your contact with the divine would be appropriate and you wouldn't commit offense and you would actually satisfy the deity and advance in life. So that process was called Diksha, the sort of preliminary purification, sanctification. Then, with the success of the Bhakti movements in India, which Krishna revived in a sense in the Bhagavad Gita, although Prabhupada says interestingly that Krishna said generally people didn't understand it, that's why it came as Lord Chaitanya. But in any case, with the advent of the Bhakti movements, people began to understand that it's not just some ghee that you offer to fire at occasional sacrifices, you actually offer your life to God. And so just as one performed Diksha before an occasional offering, if you're offering your life to God, then the Diksha is for life, because it's you're offering your life, which it's a lifelong process. So therefore, Diksha became understood in a much more profound sense as... So, let me put an Oliver so he's going to issue me. So then the Diksha means that you're sanctified. It's a lifelong sanctification, as and because the offering is not just like when you offer some ghee, it can take a second. But when you're offering your life, it may take an entire life, since we still have false ego, we still have material desires that actually prevent us from giving ourselves completely. So we give ourselves to some extent, but we hold something back, all of us, which is why Krishna holds back, and we can't see him.
Krishna holds back because we're holding back, and he warns us or promises us or offers us in the Bhagavad Gita that he reciprocates. Krishna precisely reciprocates. We can't see Krishna right now because we're holding back. So he is. And so to give yourself, atmanivedana is another term for it, to give yourself fully to Krishna, it takes a while. You have to work on it. It's because there's so many parts of us that we're so conditioned. It takes a while to gradually get all the crud off of us and become free of our reluctance. Give it like we give so much, and then we reach kind of like this bedrock false ego, like, okay, I can surrender this much, but this is too much to take. Some of the people, there's something in the course of our life, like, you know, we're good devotees, and we're disciplined, and we're doing what we're supposed to do, but then something happens that really offends us, or really, it's a blow to our ego, and like, you know, I can't, that's too much. And so, we all have our limits. We actually all do have our limits. We're not unlimitedly resilient or humble, or although you're always supposed to talk very humble, like you can compare yourself to the lowest organic life form you can think of. But in any case, so giving yourself to Krishna actually it really takes our whole life. We begin the process of giving ourselves to Krishna, and then we just keep, as we purify ourselves, with every successive stage of purification, there's more of us that we can give. So the idea is that every time we make a little more advancement, there's more of ourselves that we can give. There's another level of ourselves that we can offer to Krishna. So it really, we're kind of like excavating ourselves. It's like this excavation project where we're really sunk deep down in Maya, in the swamp of Maya. It almost takes a whole life just to excavate all of ourselves and offer it all to Krishna. And so for that grand offering, atmanivedana, where you offer yourself to Krishna, diksha, of course, we make a vow. The word for vow in Sanskrit is vrata, or in cool modern Indian language is vrat. Like to be a spoiled brat. Anyway, so the vrata, actually it's related to this word, vow. Like we have the word vote and vrat. Obviously related, or Latin, voto. Actually, what's interesting about the vrata, the vow that you make, is that that's the etymology of the word devotee, in Latin, devoto. So devoto literally means by a vow. So, for example, Spanish, se vive devoto. One lives by a vow. So it is actually in the act of making a vow, or it's in the act of vowing, that you literally, and following the vow, that you literally become a devotee. It doesn't mean, obviously, someone who's not formally initiated is a devotee, because even those not formally initiated, those who are serious, are following the same vows. So in any case, here it's formally confirmed, and Krishna takes it seriously. So it is the making and keeping of a vow that literally, etymologically, makes you a devotee. And Rupa Goswami mentions Diksha also when he says, Dikshasti Chet Pranati Vis Cha Bhajantamisha. Isn't it? Rupa Dishamrita. Krishneti Jasya Giritam Manasadriyeta. One who is chanting Krishna, Krishneti Jasya Giritam, Manasa, with the mind, Adriyeta, one should honor that person. In other words, with the mind means not physically, not by actually offering obeisances. If someone is simply chanting Hare Krishna, that person should be honored, but not with formality, not with bodily bowing and so on. But dikshasti chet, chet means if there is diksha. Dikshasti chet pranati visha vajantamisha. if there is diksha, then with obeisances, pranati vi. Nati is just another form of namaha. It's actually different ways to form a verb, a noun out of a verbal root. Here the verbal root is nam, N-A-M, which means to bow. And you can just add an A like nama, or you can add a T-I-T, nati. But, well, I know you'll find this, you'll all find this very fascinating. With Sanskrit verbal roots that end in a short A and an M, in forming the noun of T-I, you drop the M. So it's a numti, which people realize would be kind of awkward. They said nutty. Same thing in gum, to go, becomes gutti. And rum, to enjoy, becomes rati, love. Rati, gutti, nutty, and so on. So, pranativi. Pra means like directly, by directly bowing. So, pranativi, pajantamisha. But pajantamisha means if someone is initiated and actually following, because pajantamisha, worshiping the Lord, one can have diksha, but not actually follow. So Rupa Goswami is clarifying that it's not only diksha, but vajanta. One is worshiping. One is actually following. So, diksha means something. Because one formally... Another point I've made in the lectures about initiation is that we are one and different with other people. There is, of course, we know the philosophy Veda Veda. We are one with God, but we are different from God. It's one and different at the same time. And that's also in relation to other people. Other people, so there's a sense in which we're one. There is a collective consciousness. There is a, you could say, a sociological reality to this. I mean, as I've been explaining in lectures, we say a community, a family, a couple, and it means something. A family is a real thing. It's not just a bunch of people who have the same last name or live in the same house. A family is a real thing. There's a special family consciousness that only the people in that family have. There's actually a unique consciousness, so that if you are a member of that family, and if you accept that you're a member of that family, there's a certain consciousness which you are privy to, that you have access to, which actually no one else does. Isn't it? And same thing for a team, same thing for a couple, or and so on and so forth. Oh, can you hold it for me? Thank you, guys. John. So what this means, you can say in academic terms, is that sociology cannot be reduced down to a group of psychologies. It has its own reality. Come on in.
Thank you.
So, I give an example. Take a couple, the romantic couple. Then you take one individual and another individual, and if they actually... Let's say the couple actually commit to each other emotionally or whatever, then it becomes a third thing. It's like a new reality, which didn't exist before. This individual still exists, and that individual still exists, but that's nature, not just romantic, but just relationship. There's a new reality, which is that friendship, or that relationship. And there's a joint... if you think of a family... Or let's say your friendship. There is a consciousness between friends. There is a shared consciousness between friends, which neither of them would have if the friendship didn't exist. And so, in the same way, initiation, the fact of making a public vow, because diksha is a public act in the sense of one is formally initiated and society recognizes it, and that recognition by other people, that appreciation, that recognition by other people creates a new understanding, awareness of that commitment, even for the person who is initiated. That's what I'm getting at. That there is something about a public or an official or formal commitment which creates a new state of consciousness. I remember when I was young and the sexual revolution was picking up steam, it became very popular for young people to say that what's marriage is just a piece of paper. And, of course, that was a very naive thing to say. If it is merely a piece of paper, then it's not much. If it's actually a deep, heartfelt commitment, which you could say you could make it without marriage, but again, the reality of our existence as people, the reality of our existence as conscious beings is not merely private. It's also public. There's also, like our acquisition of language, like our, we understand ourselves, even our ability to understand who we are. We learn who we are by our own private reflections and meditations, but also by observing the way people respond to us. For example, I've heard from many actors, professional actors. I'm from Southern California, so I always meet actors there. And that they have a special actors, professional actors tend to have a special regard for the stage, theater. Because I was talking actually to one actor the other day, I mean, when I was before I lived on this trip in Southern California, actually, where I live, I mean, I live in a building, a building owned by a family. One of the people rents from us there is actually on television. So, you know, my neighbor across the street, Patricia, she's also a professional actor. So, they were making the point that, one of them was making the point, that when you're doing movies, it's just like, you know, you get very emotional in that, but you're really just doing it for this light in this camera. Whereas on the stage, there's like real people there. And you're constantly interacting. And I know that myself, and having lectured around the world, that when you're speaking to real people, if you're lecturing or you're an actor on a stage, that you actually feel, you can really feel how the audience is responding, and you're constantly, you know, because you're a professional performer, right? You can actually feel, and you can pick up how you're doing or how they think you're doing, and it's like moment to moment. You really can feel the audience. And so what I mean to say is that we are not merely private. We are not merely private beings. We are, we should have a healthy private dimension, but we are also public beings. And also we understand ourselves, and we learn, and we develop consciousness also by interaction with other people. There's a famous story from olden days where a king wanted to know what would happen if a human child was just left in the forest, sort of fed and protected, but without interaction with other humans. And of course, it never really became human, the child. So therefore, the act of making a public vow, whether it's a marriage vow or an initiation vow, means something. In terms of the formation of consciousness, it actually means something. I remember when I was a kid, I was a baseball fan, and when I was a little kid, I used to read books about baseball teams and baseball players, you know, when I was growing up. And so, one very common thing you'd read, especially about someone that joined the New York Yankees, because they used to be like the big team, is that when the person first put on the uniform, the pinstripe uniform, it's just like there was this change of consciousness. Because, you know, the whole tradition and everything, the Yankees. And so Krishna, in our relationship with God, first of all, the very fact that we have a relationship with God is already, you could say, brings us out of isolation. It brings us out of metaphysical isolation, the very fact that there is a relationship with Krishna or God and with other souls. In fact, imagine, let's say we threw a Hare Krishna costume party, or just, let's say we threw a costume party. for whatever reason, everyone came, and the costumes were complete, in the sense everyone's wearing masks. And let's say everyone even had some little device inside their mask that altered their voice. And some people wore platform shoes, you couldn't tell. In other words, so people were really, really very well disguised. But they still kind of were themselves in the sense of everyone has a certain personality. I mean, there's a sense in which we would still have relationships. Or imagine people, let's say to make this example even more interesting, let's say people that met at a costume party. They really didn't know each other and they met at a costume party. And all they knew about each other, they actually have internet things now, don't they? Like you have these, like these cyber worlds where you can get married and have children with someone else, and everyone is just reinvents themselves. But there's a sense in which relationships formed at a costume party would not be the deepest possible relationships. And so in a sense, that's what life on Earth is. It's a big costume party. Because actually, we're all eternal beings, we're all souls, and we're wearing these costumes, our material bodies. So if someone's male or female, or this or that color, ethnicity, or size, or age, or whatever, there's an infinite variety of bodies. But actually, within all these bodies, it's us, the real people. So spiritual life means you gradually take off your mask. You take off your costume. And everyone knows that the word persona, a person comes from the Greek word persona, meant a mask. Because in the ancient Greek plays, of course, people would wear masks. And that was your persona, that was your mask. That's the person you were playing. And so in a sense, all of us have our earthly persona, the role we're playing, but actually underneath it is us. So spiritual life, Krishna consciousness, means that we gradually develop the courage to take our mask off, because we become so attached to these costumes that we actually are afraid to see ourselves. We're afraid to literally discover ourselves. And that's why even if we take the spiritual life, it kind of goes slow and easy. And also because we're invested in the persona. The reason we're invested in this role we're playing, in this, like stage presence, all the world's a stage and so on. The reason we're invested in the roles we're playing is because every one of us has written a great part for ourselves. So we have a play going on where every actor thinks that he or she is actually the star of the theater. And none of them really understands that everyone else in the play thinks they're the star. And so because we've all created these starring roles for ourselves, that is, we're self-centered, there's a reluctance to just take the mask off and take our humble but blissful position as we really are. And so there's something amazing about a society which is interested in everything except who we really are. So that's Krishna consciousness. Now in this age, the process of taking your mask off or purifying yourself is by chanting names of God. It's not sectarian. You can do it in any language, any religious tradition. It's your choice. We choose to chant Hare Krishna because it's the basic principle of spiritual progress is the more you're having a great time, the more you're going to keep doing it. And so the word Krishna means that God is infinitely attractive, the source of all pleasure. Rama also means the source of enjoyment. So by relating to God as the source of all pleasure, as the source of all beauty, it actually becomes painless. It becomes very enjoyable to approach God because we're feeling a higher pleasure. We're outgrowing our scam, which is to pretend that we're the center of everything. Everyone has a different strategy for pretending. Like some people try to do it by showing off their intelligence or their physical beauty or their political power or their money. Some people try to show off how they don't care what anybody else thinks, and they're very concerned that everyone know that they don't care what anyone thinks. So, there's all kinds of different strategies we just have to be happy with who we really are. Who we really are is a lot more fun. I mean, it's infinitely more fun than who we're pretending we are. But who we really are is we're all eternal servants. I say servants of God. It's not that the spiritual world is like a big factory where, you know, or something like that, and you're a worker, you're a servant, indentured servant. I mean, to say eternal servants of Krishna or God, in the same way that God is eternally serving us. I mean, we get life and everything's coming from God. So it's really a question of reciprocating. Krishna or God is detached. So the good news is that God does not have an anger management problem. And also God is not jealous. I mean, jealousy is not like a great virtue, especially irrational jealousy. So, I mean, if God really like had ego in the pejorative sense of the term, so that if you don't worship him, he's going to mess you up so bad that... To be perfectly honest, God has really been depicted almost as a monster here and there in world history. Not by everybody, but there have been really monstrous... I mean, what else would you call someone that tortures his own children forever for mental crimes? I mean, not even for doing anything. It's like, if I didn't do anything, Dad, I don't care. I know what you were thinking. Into the fire. Somehow or other, in the minds of certain people who, by coincidence, were also addicted to animal killing and people killing, in the minds of certain people, God is really just a monster. So that, not only that, in terms of punishment fitting the crime, if let's say for Like in the context of eternity, eternity is a very, very long time. It's like a lot of zeros after the one. And so, imagine eternity. The human mind can't really wrap itself around eternity because it's eternity. And so in the context of eternity, let's say an average lifespan, let's say 40, 50 years, is an infinitesimal, infinite small amount of time. And so, to say that the crime took this long, and what if the crime was a mental crime? It was more like a crime of omission, like I didn't accept the only true doctrine, or whatever. It could just be a crime of omission. You might have been a good person otherwise. You might have actually even believed in God otherwise. You might have, you know, mowed your lawn and smiled at your neighbors and fed your children and, you know, made full stops at stop signs, which would be a completely new concept. In Southern California, would be a completely new concept. But in other words, maybe you were actually a good person, then you just committed a mental crime of omission. First of all, it's a mental thing, because you just didn't believe something, and to believe is a mental activity. So you didn't believe something, and therefore you're going to be tortured for that, for a mental crime. And you're going to be tortured forever. Most of us, if we were tortured, it would take like, really it's like almost like 1 or 2 seconds to reverse any previous decision which had led to that situation. So imagine, you're sort of like a nice person, but you just somehow or other didn't believe a particular dogma, and therefore you're going to be tortured. And even if, like, after the first second or two of torture, you realize, yeah, I guess, maybe I should have believed that. But even then, even if after 1 or 2 seconds you believe it, still for millions, in other words, for all eternity, you're going to be tortured in the cruelest, most horrible, vicious ways forever, just because you mentally didn't believe something. The evil of this, if this were true, which it obviously isn't, God would be so absolutely evil. God would be such a monster that it's So one point I've made in lectures is that you know PTSD is, right? Post-traumatic stress disorder. Like war veterans or children that saw something like violent or abusive. So in other words, when you have a traumatic experience, it happens a lot with the people returning from war, then post-traumatic, after the trauma, there's stress. There's still like this, you're still kind of shaken up. And you're not, it's called a normal response to abnormal experiences. PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. And so it's a common thing. Common clinical thing. So, PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, can also occur at a civilization level. And I think there's no question that Western civilization, I mean our whole civilization, is suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder in terms of their expression of religion. Because so someone who's suffering this PTSD can't really be objective or rational because there's like this, almost like this aftermath of trauma. And again, if you think about, in clinical terms, just in clinical scientific terms, what constitutes a traumatic experience, what types of stimulus are sufficient to traumatize a normal human being? And then if you look at the history of religion, anywhere, but say in the West, where you had some of the most, let's say, intelligent, not wise, but intelligent people in Europe working full-time, thinking up the most horrible, painful, cruel ways to torture other human beings. You had the Inquisition, you had university professors in Europe writing learned essays on how to, this is after the work of Newton, on how to properly identify a witch so you don't burn alive the wrong woman. Make sure you burn the right woman alive. And you had university professors writing essays on this. I mean, the Crusades, where I think one pope finally, when they were getting to Jerusalem, it was too hard to figure out who's who because it was such a multicultural situation. So he just said, well, kill them all and let God sort them out. So by the time the first crusade reached Jerusalem, they just basically killed everybody, including Christians. They just basically killed everybody. So, the Inquisition, all these things, the horrific wars of the 16th century between the Protestants and the Catholics, it just goes on and on and on and on. The monument in the center of Oxford, England, the famous college town, right in the center of old Oxford, a monument to three Oxford theology professors who were burned alive at the stake, I'm sure, because they wouldn't convert to Catholicism. It was a horrible, horrible period in English history where there was like, they kept changing monarchs because a monarch would be killed or would die a natural death or whatever. And every time a Catholic monarch came to power, everyone in the country had to be a Catholic. And they opened all the monasteries and everything, and then did the service in Latin. And then, like, literally 5 minutes later, that person died, and the Protestant monarch took power. You had to close all the monasteries, stop saying the Mass in Latin, say it in English. And so these three, when Queen Mary, Bloody Queen Mary, when she took power, these were theology professors who were actually dedicating their lives to Jesus. They actually did it, but because they disagreed on certain details of theology, they were burned alive. So, what I mean to say is, this kind of behavior over a long period of time is traumatic. And it's not only traumatic for an individual, it's actually traumatic at a social level, at a civilization level. So I think it's fair to say that our civilization is suffering from the symptoms of post-traumatic stress. And I mean, the whole attitude toward, and because it's embedded, it's encoded in the collective memory. As we know, it's like, you know, people pass on their traumas from generation to generation, a progenie in progenie. I mean, it's like with the parents, you know, parents are very fearful or are very anxious. It's communicated to the child, not only in the womb, But afterwards, I mean, a little infant growing up with parents who are traumatized by something, I mean, the trauma definitely gets passed on. Maybe not precisely in the same form. And so there really is a transmission of this traumatic experience of religion. I mention this because in our Krishna conscious movement, we're trying to spiritualize things and, you know, do our part. Maybe small now, but history is on our side, we tell ourselves. So the idea is that we're trying to spread Krishna consciousness in a civilization where some people are religious fanatics and some people are fanatically against religious institutions because of this collective trauma. And for other reasons as well. There's also a tendency for people who fancy themselves intellectual to think they're above, or they've intellectually outgrown a personal theism, which I think is a philosophically very naive way of looking at it, but there you go. They're naive. So anyway, we're trying to present, and now we're trying to teach Krishna consciousness, and taking a formal vow, and promising to follow certain moral principles. I won't say it because I don't want to give them away, because they're going to be, our contestants are going to be trying to win prizes. So following certain principles and chanting Krishna's names and really dedicating yourself to having a spiritual life is a very powerful thing. And the Pope is in America now. So, anyway, there's a need for general spiritual awakening. And ultimately, I will end this little talk by saying that something I've mentioned many times before, that around 1,000 years ago, approximately 1,000 years ago, a leading philosopher in Europe, and of course, 1,000 years ago means he was obviously a Christian philosopher because they didn't have any other kind back then, gave an argument for the existence of God. And the argument he gave is called the ontological proof for the existence of God. Ontological means an argument based on examining the nature of existence. And so the argument he gave is that God is that being, than whom no greater being can be conceived. And then he added that if you say God doesn't exist, I can conceive a greater God, namely one that does exist. Sort of a trick argument. But what I want to focus on is the assumption he made that God is that being than whom no greater being can be conceived. So what that means is that the greatest conception of God is the truest. If God is infinitely great, so you can't conceive of a greater being, then it follows, it seems to me, that the highest conception of God is truest. It comes closest to God. It may not be a perfect description, it may not describe everything, but it's the closest. It's the truest. Because that's basically Anselm's argument. He's saying, if you say God doesn't exist, it's greater to exist than not to exist. That's his basic point. That existing is a lot better than not existing. And therefore, a God that exists is better than a God that doesn't exist. It's tricky, but I don't want to go into the tricky part of the argument. But so instead, I would say to Anselm, as I always say, true, the highest conception of God is the truest, but so there, well, we can think of a much higher concept of God than one who's vengeful and cruel. We can think of a God who's actually merciful. And we can think of a God who's infinitely beautiful, who's infinitely playful, who's infinitely charming, who plays the most seductive music. Not in the erotic sense of seductive, but But we can think of a God who is just infinitely attractive. Infinitely attractive. And doesn't coerce us into submission by invoking a cosmic law of the jungle. You know, might makes right. So, Rupa, and as I always say, Rupa Goswami gives the same argument in the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. Because in there he says that Krishna is the highest form of God because it's the highest concept. So Rupa Goswami in the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu is basically giving the same argument as Anselm. And so taking an argument to be true, that the greatest, the most glorious concept is the truest because God is infinitely great. Therefore, we would say that the most attractive, most glorious concept of God that we find within world civilizations is Krishna. And therefore, the conception of Krishna is truest. And that's what Rupa is really saying. So, those who are being initiated are really joining formally, I should say. They're Vedic Brahmins, but they're actually... They're joining a great, really an eternal tradition, because this stuff is going on all over the universe. And it's going on in other universes, because it would be actually quite, what's the word, provincial to think there's only one universe. Actually, even though the whole thing of string theory and modern physics and everything to talk about so many universes, the Vedic literature actually talks about billions of universes. So, Yasya Prabhavati, Yasya Prabhavato Jagananda Koti Kotishu. Koti is 10 million, and Koti Kotishu means 10 million times 10 million times 10 million, etc. It's a very big number. You do physics, don't you? So, what is that? How much is that?
10 million to the 10 million.
10 million times 10 million?
To the 10 million. Well, as you said, 10 million times 10 million times 10 million. 10 million times would be 10 million to the 10 million.
How many zeros is that? It's a lot of zeros. What?
A Google.
yeah, it's a very big number. Your home calculator probably can't deal with it. So, and that's of universes. That's how many universes. So it's a very big creation. And that's why if someone says, I'm God, it's like, read the job description. So Krishna is so great, and even though, I mean, Krishna, imagine someone who can also just say, I can nisha sita kala matava lamya jaganti loma bilaja jagrandanata, that Krishna can literally breathe out the universe. It's an organic process. It's not like there's some big, you know, universe factory somewhere and there's all kinds of smoke and flames. Krishna is so great, God is so great, he can just exhale. You can just exhale and breathe out trillions and quadrillions of universes just by breathing. And then inhale them. And instead of the time of that one breath of Krishna as far as Mahavishnu, which is like over 300 trillion years actually, which is about roughly the time given for a universe, 300 trillion years, long time. So 300 trillion years, 311 trillion years, you know, give or take a few trillion, is just one breath of God in that particular form. God has many forms, but in that particular form, Mahavishnu, Great Vishnu, Madhya Vishnu, it's just one breath. So I may say I'm God, but when I breathe out, I just produce millions of germs, not millions of universes. Of course, we could think of a germ as a universe in itself, but that's more poetry than astronomy. So, poetically, everything is possible. So next time you get a toothache, just write a poem about it. Don't go to the dentist. Anyway, so Krishna But imagine being able to do all that, and yet, in your original form, just playing with your friends. Like they have those advertisements you see on TV, where someone's just, you know, sitting on a beach, beautiful beach, on a beach chair with, you know, a little wireless computer, and they can. So they're off in some tropical resort, and that's their office. I guess you don't have to worry about sand getting in your computer. Unless, anyway, you probably do have to worry about that. So, but Krishna's just playing. People, there is a concept in our culture that if you can do great things, if you can do powerful things, and yet you yourself are relaxed and away from it all, having a good time, playing, and yet almost effortlessly you can still move things in a powerful way. That's held up as a very desirable, attractive state of being, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And so the supreme example of that is Krishna. He can just be playing with his friends in the most enchanting world of all. And yet, all the universe is going on just by his will. So, this is an ancient tradition, and people are being initiated in this tradition all over the universe, actually, in many universes. So it's like, you know, there's solidarity here. Cosmic solidarity. Any questions on these points?
I do have a question. I'm hesitant to bring it up, but I've wanted to for a long time. So that in the fifth canto, the descriptions there sound, to me, make God sound very harsh. So I wonder if there's something that you could say about it.
Oh, the punishments.
You're speaking on these points.
So. Two things. I think even Bhaktivinoda Thakur says to some extent there may be hyperbole.
Me?
Exaggeration.
Okay. Bhaktivinoda Thakur says?
Yeah. It's like our parents, like, you know, sometimes your parents say, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. And they're not really going to do it. It's just to kind of put you in order. Mm-hmm. My parents, like my father, sometimes said, I'm going to do something like that. He never actually did it, but. So, I mean, there is punishment. Just read the news. You can see there's, you know, terrible things happening to people in this world. Not that there's no punishment. But there's another point, and that is that the punishment is actually a dream. In that Krishna puts over us a virtual reality machine, which is the material body. That's the material body. It's actually a virtual reality machine. We get hooked up to it. So the soul, it's like a good parent will never actually injure their child. A good parent will never actually injure them. I mean, good parents don't like break their children's bones or knock their teeth out and things like that. You know, mutilate them. So Krishna, actually, since the beginning of time, which has no beginning, Krishna has never actually injured any soul. No soul has ever been injured. This virtual reality machine is put over us, and then according to actually an objective system of punishment and reward, we experience the universe. But nothing is really happening to us. It's like, I may think I have so much money, but actually I don't have the money. I'm just a soul. And in this external world, I'm just somehow acting the part of someone that has this much money. But actually, everything belongs to Krishna. So in the same way the bad things can happen to us, we're dreaming that it's happening to us, but actually it's just happening to the virtual reality machine, which is still, you know, kind of a heavy experience. But it's not really happening to us. And some descriptions are there in the scriptures just to kind of, you know, like a parent that says, I'll do this or that. Yeah. Although there is a quid pro quo. If we cause harm to others or if we cause suffering to others, it does come back to us. Mm-hmm. It does come back. Anything else?
What's that part of the fifth canto?
Oh, the description of certain punishments in the next life for people doing bad things in this life. Yes.
Just a confusion about it. Does karma always act in next life? then we actually can get recovery.
Well, according to John Lennon, instant karma can also get you. So, it's variable.
There are references of instant karma in the same life.
Yeah, you can read the stories about it. So, I mean, it's not, there's no rule or law about it. It's just, it can come in different ways, different times. But it comes. Yes?
I was trying to understand the other day about, when Jesus died at the cross.
When
Jesus died at the cross, he was doing it to save us, to take away our sin.
Well, that's the interpretation. From a scholarly point of view, if you actually study the whole thing, how certain books were written, the fact that, that was a post-mortem interpretation. And first of all, I think the whole concept is kind of flawed. I'm not criticizing Jesus. This is not about Jesus. This is about interpretations of Jesus. There is evidence that should we record this?
Yes.
Yeah,
you want to record?
I guess we could. For example, the scholarly point of view, if you study the four Gospels, the one that appears to be the oldest, Jesus actually at times somebody says, "Father, what's going on? Why is this happening?" And then he dies. And then later they added things like, so also, God is not subject to primitive Middle Eastern tribal law. So that actually one of the main accusations brought against Jesus before Pontius Pilate was that he was claiming to free people from their sins. Because in the Jewish culture at that time, it was believed that only God can relieve people of sins. And so to claim to relieve people of sin was considered to be arrogating, taking upon yourself certain powers, which human being can't do. Although we understand that someone can have power of attorney from God. Just like an initiation process that one can become relieved of sins because the guru or a teacher can have power of attorney. But in any case, the idea that quite even during his life, according to the Old Testament, or the New Testament, Hare Krishna. Hey, Guruji. Oh, go on in. Hey, look, we haven't done the vow yet. I'm long-winded tonight, so. Now, consider this. Even during the life of Jesus, as it is alleged to, the description given in the New Testament, Jesus freed people from their sins. For example, there was a lady who was going to be stoned to death for adultery or something. Jesus said, whoever is without sin, throw the first stone, and then everyone chickened out. Good. And then according to the story, Jesus said, all right, just go and don't sin anymore. You can be free from your past sins, just knock it off. Don't sin anymore. Now, in the life of Jesus, he never told her, wait a second, let me get out my Boy Scout knife and cut myself, I have to bleed for you to be free of your sin. You have to be washed by my blood. There was nothing like that. It was just Jesus acted like a normal guru in the Vedic tradition. It's exactly what happens at the time of initiation. Like whatever sins one has committed, just don't sin anymore. And then you get Papa Moksha. You're free from your sins. So throughout the ministry of Jesus during his life, when he offered people freedom or redemption from their sins, there was no dogma attached to it that someone had to die, someone had to bleed. It was just, lead a proper spiritual life. And then It's natural. If you have a child, and the child has done something really wrong, and the child is genuinely sorry and really is not going to do it anymore, then it's just over, isn't it? If you love your child, the child has learned the lesson, then it's over. Just move on. So it's not a very like mysterious thing. It's just like parental common sense. So the idea that there has to be blood for blood, that if you, there's an argument given by Paul of Tarsus, a person who during his entire adult life was persecuting someone or other. Before he joined the Jesus movement, he was killing followers of Jesus. And after he joined, he was basically philosophically, religiously persecuting everyone else. Not violently, but ridiculing, insulting every other religion that he ever came across. So he gives the argument that everyone deserves to be killed because no one follows God perfectly, which is true. None of us follow God perfectly. It's like saying to your child, well, you're not a perfectly obedient child, so then I'm going to kill you. But I love you so much, I'll kill myself instead. That's the basic argument. Because Jesus was fully man, fully God, that's the Nicene Creed. So therefore, God, I mean, if my parents would have said to me, you know, you're imperfect, like, surprise, surprise, I'm imperfect, therefore we really should kill you. Because after all, what do parents do with imperfect children but kill them, obviously? That's what any good, loving parent would do with an imperfect child. So, God, our supreme parent, should, of course, kill us, which we can all understand, see the logic of that. However, God has decided that he loves us. God so loved the world that he killed himself instead. Or he killed his good son. And what if my parents would have called me into their room when I was a kid and said, you're imperfect, so we're going to kill you. But actually, we love you so much, we'll kill your older brother. Because we got to kill somebody. There's something very sick about this. I mean, it's funny, but it's also something deeply unhealthy about all this. Like, someone has to be killed. Because God, as a loving, as God, can't just say, okay, I forgive you, you little whatever. You know, I forgive you, now just live properly. No. Even if you're sorry, someone has to be killed. It's the law. Which was brought up very nicely in that movie, Narnia. Narnia movie where the white witch says, it's the law, I have a right to, you know, take the guy and kill him because it's the law. That's the idea. God is under a law, which is actually a rather primitive tribal law. And so you have to be washed by the blood. That, of course, comes from the ancient Jewish belief that the soul, of course, is sacred, and the soul, or life, life is sacred, and life somehow is contained in the blood. So therefore, just as in let's say, Hinduism or in Vedic rituals, there's ashram where you sprinkle water on your hand, or you sprinkle water on your head, or during the typical puja ceremony, water is offered to God and then sprinkled on everyone, or you sprinkle water. So this exact same ashram, this exact same procedure was followed in the Jewish temple in Jerusalem, but not with water, with blood. So blood was sprinkled and everything. Yes, it's a little gross.
Human blood or animal blood?
Animal blood. They would sacrifice animals, and the blood of the animal was like the purifying agent. It's not, you know, the most sublime concept, but that's what they thought. So, therefore, in the book of John, in ancient times, was considered to be not historically accurate, and written a few generations after Jesus in West Turkey. And the book of John, which says, behold the Lamb of God that takes away the sins of the world. So what they did is they kind of appropriated this symbolism and said that just as in the Jewish temple rituals, animals are sacrificed and their blood is then sprinkled on people to purify them, so God made an animal sacrifice of his son. And since Jesus is God, God made an animal sacrifice of himself. And therefore that blood, everyone is purified by blood. This is sort of wonderfully Middle Eastern. And, you know, it's just one way of looking at things. So there's the argument that a loving parent finding a child to be imperfect should kill the child. But instead of killing the child, the parent will kill a good child or kill himself, since somebody has to kill, because when a child's disobedient, someone has to be killed. And this is all done through blood. And this is the only true religion. And God will torture forever anyone that has a slightly different belief. And since God is going to torture everyone forever that has even a slightly different belief, we can do God's work in this world by beginning to torture and kill people now that don't have this belief. And since anyone that believes a false doctrine will be tortured forever in the most excruciating, horrible ways, forever, anyone that preaches a false doctrine is actually leading all of that person's followers to eternal torture, and therefore to murder that person, and to murder them in an exemplary way, you know, like as painfully as possible, is actually an act of kindness upon other people. So therefore you're actually, I mean, just your basic moral pragmatism tells you that it's morally positive, and it's actually the greatest, most heroic thing you can do is, in the most horrible possible ways, kill people that slightly disagree with you. I'm sort of laying out how people used to think. You know, some people probably still do, they just can't get away with it anymore. Oh, bye-bye, thanks for coming.
Bye, Mom.
The reason I mention this is because we are trying to teach something which sounds to some people like religion. We are trying to teach the spiritual knowledge in a civilization which has been traumatized. I mean, on a societal level, historically traumatized by these views. And so that's the environment that we're trying to teach in.
I have a question.
Yes.
When a disciple takes initiation from a spiritual master, does the spiritual master suffer anything from taking some sins from the disciple?
Depends on how annoying the disciple is. It's often said that the guru takes on the karma and so on. That I don't have any scriptural reference for that. It's not only stated in the Bhagavatam anywhere. It's certainly not stated in the Bhagavad Gita. Prabhupada sometimes referred to it. It is a very serious commitment on both parts. Serious, I mean, for the guru, the disciple is not just a trophy. Like, I bagged another one. So, even if you think of raising a child, I mean, to have a child is a very serious commitment. It's an emotional commitment. It can be, you know, it takes a lot. So, there's a basic principle of justice which we have to remember that operates in the universe. And that is, people really do get what they deserve. There really is justice in the universe. And Krishna himself very strongly and repeatedly affirms this principle of justice. In Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, for example, Samoham Sarva Bhutesha, I'm equal to all creatures. Namete Shosti Napriya, I don't hate anyone, I don't favor anyone. Krishna basically tells all of us the same thing our parents told us. You know, if we had siblings, brothers or sisters, that were fair, you know, we're just treating you all the same, we love you all equally, isn't it? I mean, that's what every good parent tells their children. And that's what Krishna tells us. Krishna says, I reciprocate. Krishna says, you get what you deserve. So therefore, the idea that one person suffers for what someone else has done is just not what Krishna teaches. Now, if someone accepts the position of a guru, which means a teacher, you know, accept that position of being a spiritual teacher, and you do your job properly, then it is, you know, it's a very serious thing. And you do take on that responsibility. So, the same you do when you take on a serious friendship or have children or whatever. These are very serious responsibilities. The guru doesn't take the karma. Like, let's say I initiate someone who was a thief, so now I have thief karma or something. I have the karma. I mean, it's not that you take on the karma in the sense that I have to get... It's not... Actually, Krishna, because we, Rupa Goswami says in Bhakti Samrita Sindhu, in the beginning, that one of the first symptoms of devotional service when one becomes freed from sinful reactions. And the Brahma Sanghita says that karmani nirthahati kintucha bhakti vajam. Krishna personally burns up all the karma of someone that takes a devotional service. And Krishna says also, mam chajo yavicharena bhakti. One who serves me and following the principles without deviating transcends the material world and comes to the level of the spiritual platform. So many, many references to show that if someone is initiated, if someone takes up serious spiritual life and actually does it, actually follows, that they are liberated. And, you know, it's like when you're, you have an operation and it's a success and you're free of the disease, but still you're convalescing. It takes a while before you can really realize all the benefits of a successful medical procedure. So, the guru doesn't become karmic or karmically tainted. And Prabhupada did say that, I mean, it is a burden. Especially Prabhupada traveled around the world, initiated thousands of people, so without question. Even just frankly, even just from a human psychological point of view, to take responsibility for so many people is a serious thing. So, as far as transfer of karma, it's something which is not really mentioned in the Bhagavatam, it's not mentioned in the Gita. But Krishna, it does say, Rama Sankta, Krishna burns up the karma of a devotee, and the transactions, the relationship between a devotee and Krishna are in a sense mediated by the guru's transparent medium. So those things also, so you may say that there's a certain conducting back and forth, whatever, but the relationship between a guru and disciple is not certainly not material, certainly spiritual, and Krishna really keeps his eye on it and rewards and punishes us accordingly, but it's just his relationship between a teacher and a student. And it's a family relationship also, because it's not just like, I know when I went back to college after, of course, being practicing Christian consciousness for many years, I went back to college, finished all my degrees, and one of the first courses I took, the first semester I went back years ago, was a course in Greek philosophy at UCLA. And it was kind of startling for me because I had been immersed for many, many years in this culture of guru-disciple relationships and so on. And the teacher was sort of this older guy, and at one point there was a window that needed to be shut for whatever reason, so he said something like, oh, the window needs to be shut, so like, none of the students jumped up to go close the window. Mm-hmm. Like in a more traditional culture, not only just Vedic, but just more traditional culture. There's some elder person as a teacher, or, you know, window needs to be shut. There, you know, people would just sort of jump up and shut the window, but he had to kind of like walk over there and struggle the window himself. All the students were just, you know, like, yeah, shut the window if you don't want the window closed, go shut it. And I just realizing how different the culture was. I remember I'm in California, I remember a devotee, Gandhi, this nice lady, was teaching at UCSB, University of California, Santa Barbara. And she showed me this booklet they gave, which they gave at that university to all professors and TAs and teaching assistants who are from other countries. And basically, in sort of a polite, diplomatic way, they explained that American students are kind of animals. And you may be shocked. You may be shocked at your experience in the classroom. They didn't say animal, but they kind of, you know, they tried to do it in a very politically correct way, but that's basically what it's saying. That American college students are out of control. And so you may be, you know, don't be shocked, because you may be used to a more deferential culture toward teachers, but anyway, it's, so any other question? No? So, we'll proceed then. Okay, if you've been initiated, this is your last chance before we close the doors and the flight takes off. This will be your last chance to deplane. So where are the beads? I think I already sold them. No, they're upstairs. The beads are upstairs in my bedroom on the table there.